Well, good morning, everybody. Hope you had a nice time for those of you who are out of town and enjoy Toronto. Weather's terrible, but we had I think the week before this we had like extraordinary weather. It was like 17 degrees, which is really unusual here. It's probably one of those outlier tail events, right, in the weather side. I also noticed here there's something reserved for TD. What do? They had a special deal here. Hi, we just got started. So what I'd like to talk to you about is rethinking Basel II. First of all, Santiago, I don't know if you want to say some opening words or just. Okay, well, I'll introduce myself. I didn't do that, actually. I'm Tony Pache. I'm a CRO for Citibank Canada. I've been doing that now for about a year, so I moved away from operational risk. Prior to that, I was head of operational risk. Citi on the policy and the AMA side, and prior to that was a few Canadian banks like Bank of Montreal. I think I did them all except for maybe one or two, Bank of Montreal, CIBC, and at one time Royal Bank. My background prior to that is actually in trading and investment banking. And one of the things that I always say is I'm a banker first, a risk manager second, and perhaps, when I say perhaps, a quant third. My academic background is in theoretical physics. So I do have a lot of the quant background, but what really scares me about the application of quantitative methods to banking is that a lot of it is in some ways misguided, and that's going to be part of my talk. The other thing I'd like to say is please feel free to interrupt me at any time. I'm going to say certain things that maybe some of you are not going to agree with, so that's good, because through disagreement, hopefully comes learning. So challenge me on anything. I won't feel upset. I'll actually welcome it. Now, why do we say rethinking Basel II for operational risk? I think there has to be some serious and fundamental rethinking of the entire approach. Basel II was a great promise, especially for operational risk, because it was something new. And when it came to market risk, it was, well, how do we tweak what we have now? How do we get it more precise? How do we get it, solve some of the mathematical issues associated with that? Credit risk was pretty much in the same thing. We had all sorts of big impetus to model credit risk, and people had made a lot of advances relative to Basel I, and so Basel II came along, and it was a one way to phrase it is a mathematization of credit risk, right? And then came along operational risk, and some of us, and I recognize some familiar faces in the room, that were involved in actually what came up to, be in Basel II. Now, one of the things that's actually astonishing, and after we achieved it, we sort of all scratched our head and said, we may have created a little monster here, which in my view we actually did, which was when it comes to credit risk, the regulators never approved the use of internal models. Right? There's a whole history, a whole literature there on the use of models for modeling credit risk, but the regulators said, not enough evidence that these models actually work, this is complex, and we need more time to actually make it part of the regulations. But here came operational risk with no real history. In fact, when it first started, people used to call it the other risk. No one knew what it was. It was everything but market or credit risk. And the regulators came up with a lot of push from the industry, so I'm not blaming the regulators, a lot of push from the industry with the AMA. So here it is, we're going to model operational risk. No one knew how to do it, but we're going to do it. So it got baked into the regulations. And that seemed like a very good thing at the time because it gave us the opportunity to really do some fresh thinking in operational risk. But what has emerged in the last 10 years for sure, maybe a little bit longer, is that the promise of this discipline of a better approach to the management of which measurement is supposed to support never came about. And so what I'm going to talk about today is a little bit of where we are and what, in my view, we need to do. So if I could get this thing to work. So this is, my abstract. And just as a recap, capital charges, most financial institutions largely determined by an actuarial model that provides little insight into the actual risk factors that drive operational risk exposure, remains an abstraction for most business managers. And that's the big failure. Most business managers, and I've seen this not just at Citi, but at other banks too, really their eyes glaze over when they talk about operational risk measurement, because it's a number that really tells you nothing about the risk. It tells you, if you have a whole bunch of data and you apply a whole bunch of abstract mathematics, most of which people who are business people don't understand, you get some number. And the question becomes, okay, I don't understand how to do it, I don't understand what went into it, and I don't understand what to do with it when I get it. So that's why the abstraction. The other thing is the operational risk reporting largely consists of reporting losses after the fact, most of which have been actively looked into extensively by other groups, and then they're reported once a quarter or once a month, whatever, to some senior group. And again, the eyes glaze over all over again, because most of the people who you're reporting this have actually been intimately involved in the resolution of those large losses. So what to do? What I'm going to do is, this is a quantitative group, I understand that, but I'd like to just give you an overview of some of the issues that I see on the quantitative side, and then some on the qualitative side. So I'm briefly going to go an overview, and so let's just look at this for a second. Okay, so you all know this, I'm not going to go into it, but I'm going to focus on this, the advanced measurement approach. So the big promise of operational risk management through the AMA was that instead of getting a linear association between capital and gross income, I could actually get a non-linear to reflect that I could do something about it, that operational risk just doesn't grow with my gross income. As I get bigger, I don't get more operational risk. But more importantly, I could do something about it, right? So instead of just saying it is what it is because of your past history, it said if I could somehow demonstrate that I manage my operational risk better, then I can get a capital savings. And this is where most of the failures occurred, because most of the models, at least the ones I'm familiar with, perhaps you're familiar with other ones and I'd be interested in knowing about them, actually never answer that question. Oh, they do, they say, through trickery more than anything else, but they actually don't answer that question, which is of most importance to bank management. Right? After all, some of you I know are researchers here, but those of you who work for banks, ultimately the models must serve to answer some business question. So let me just go quickly through this, because you're all familiar with it. So this is a typical AMA implementation, right? You look at loss history, you apply some kind of analytic process, a black box to most of them. You get a frequency severity, do some either analytic or Monte Carlo, you get a number here. And then people say, oh, well, I need to put something in there that reflects what I do. Because all up to here, it's really the past and perhaps some scenario analysis, which I'll get into in a second, to get you to this number, right? Your capital at 99.9. And then you apply what is called a qualitative adjustment factor, which could be quite intricate in its approach, but let's face it, at the end of it, it's the emperor has no clothes. It's basically a fudge factor to get the number you want, right? So you either increase the capital or you decrease the capital based on this. So what are some of the issues with this approach? Well, first of all, you started your loss history, right? Unfortunately, most banks look something like this. It's very spotty, right? You don't have enough data to actually do anything about it. So people say, I get a very severity distribution that looks very skinny. Obviously, that's not appropriate. It doesn't tell me, what my real risk is. It just tells me that on a day-to-day basis, I may have some operational losses. So we look at external losses, or X heavily represented here, So as you know, we could give you a lot more data if you look at external losses. But there's a lot of issues with that too, which is mainly, so I, one of the effects of that is I broaden my my exposure, right? So my severity distribution isn't as skinny anymore. And the big questions here, though, is, first of all, are they relevant? You know, which losses do I actually put in? There's been many attempts to try to do that. At Citi, we have a rigorous process of deciding what's relevant and what's not relevant. The other issue is scaling. You know, there are some scaling models out there, but again, it's very hard to say. Take you know, practical examples. SocGen, rogue trading, $7 billion. Right? If you're, let's put it down. Let's say Citibank Canada. I'll make it a little bit more personal. Citibank Canada, we do have trading operations. Suppose we were independent of the parent, a complete independent entity. Okay, we're a $12 billion on-balance sheet firm, so very modest in its size relative to, say, the Canadian banks. But you know, we do some of the most complex derivatives on the planet here in Canada. So if I look at it and say, well, how am I going to take a $7 billion loss at SocGen? Is it relevant to me? Yes, because we do trading. Now, how do I use it? Is $7 billion enough? If I had $7 billion, do I need enough capital? How much capital do I need against that kind of an event for the kind of business we do here at Citibank Canada? And frankly, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd like to ask a similar question to see if the question even has relevance, right? So let's say I ask you, you know, in round numbers, we'll make it, you own a house, okay? One of the risks you're exposed to is that your house will be destroyed, say, in a fire. Let's, as I said, make it in round numbers so it's easy. $1 million house. How much capital do you need to protect yourself against a fire? My answer would be $1 million. Anything less than that, you won't have enough to rebuild your house. Now, the beauty is that I don't have to put up $1 million because basically I buy protection by someone else, right, like an insurance company that pools all these various losses, potential losses together, and they collect enough premium from me and everybody else that they can build a pool of greater than $1 million so that if my house burns down, they could give me $1 million. But I'd be foolish for me to do some kind of probability-weighted expected or unexpected loss and say, you know, for a house of $1 million, I need, let's say, $500,000 or, you know, whatever. I don't want to, I'm not going to use $500,000 because that looks like, you know, the halfway mark. But let's say it's $700,000. Well, you know, $700,000 is going to cover some of my loss, but it's not going to cover all of my loss. So one of the fundamental problems with operational risk in trying to put capital at the institutional level is precisely that problem. You'll never have enough capital for big, large tail events. What really should have happened is that the industry got together and created a pool so that, and I know there's lots of political and business issues with that, but would it created a pool so that I, as a Citibank Canada, let's say I was a standalone institution, as I mentioned beginning in that particular case, I could probably pay a premium to some kind of pool, and then if I suffered a $7 billion loss, I would have, could draw on that pool and be okay, very similar to my analogy with a you know, personal situation with a house. So the whole fundamental premise of putting capital at the institutional level to operational risk, I think, has to be questioned. Remember, if you have the same thing, this is not particular to operational risk. It's particular to operational risk because you don't have essentially diversification. If I was a bank and I had only one loan, I'd have the same problem. Right? If I had a bank and I had $100 billion loan let's make it more realistic, $2 billion loan to Bell Canada as we did at one time. Well, if that was my only loan on the book, how much capital would I need to make sure that if that loan goes into default, I would need. Well, maybe there's some recovery, so let's say 50% recovery. I need at least $1 billion. So it's not particular to operational risk. It's particular to any risk. But in those, I don't, you know, I usually have a portfolio. So I'm like the little insurance company within my own bank. With operational risk, you don't have that. So this whole thing about, you know, spending a lot of time trying to get this very precise, it sort of reminds me of, you know, trying to get a very precise number for something that's not very relevant when you come down to it. Could add scenario analysis. I know you had a paper yesterday on scenario analysis. I'm not familiar with it, so maybe what I say is totally wrong, given what that paper said. But my big issue with scenario analysis has been from day one is that scenario analysis may help you get the severity, the loss given the event, probably sufficiently accurate. But in terms of probability, trying to get managers to try to estimate a probability is just intellectually, I think, illogical. Right? How can you get someone to estimate something that's rare? By the very definition, we have no intuition about these things because they're so rare. So to try to get some kind of group consensus about the probability, we know all the studies that have been done, even on much more frequent occurrence, there's all sorts of biases, right? The probability of an event that happens, if we were to have an earthquake here in Toronto, and then you would ask people, including professors of geology, you know, what's the probability of an earthquake happening? Study after study showing that there's a huge bias in that. What they normally do is recent events get weighted much higher, and events that are far away get less weight. And that, by the way, I forget the name of the book right now, but you know, if anybody's interested, I could give it to you. There was a study done by Stanford University professors amongst experts. So these biases are not just amongst people who, you know, are not like the man in the typical man or woman on the street. These are even experts that overestimate recent events and underestimate events that haven't occurred. So there's a whole, you know, you can easily put this in here, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to solve before you do that, and there's no easy solution. And the question of outliers always comes in, right? And typical in, and I've done this myself, but typical of a quant approach is to say, well, the outliers just makes every life difficult, so we'll just ignore them. But that's where the risk is, right? The outliers is what we're really worried about. We're not worried about these day-to-day, at least, right around here, sort of. We're not worried from it in the sense of the survival of the bank, right? I like this new concept. I don't know how many of you have heard about this, but Basel III, as it's being called, introduced the concept of going concern and gone concern. And so going concern, you may be interested in all these losses here. Gone concern, you're really concerned about the outliers, right? A stock chain rogue trading is really an outlier. And to ignore it, you're ignoring what the purpose of capital is to make sure the depositors are protected in a gone concern, not in a going concern. So that's an interesting point, too. A lot of what I said up to here really applies to that gone concern. Because if you're modeling day-to-day kind of losses, you know, credit card frauds and typical losses of not these gone concern type of losses, most of this is actually well-developed and pretty useful. Right? A lot of the things that I'm saying where the real problems are have to do with the purpose of capital and a gone concern concept. So, you know, you apply all this and you get a severity distribution that takes into account more of the rare events. And then, you know, you do some kind of mathematical modeling, and here comes, you know, all the other things you must do, which are not so much from the modeling point of view, but some of the things we talked about, you know, like data quality, especially if you're introducing losses that are not yours. But even within yours, there's huge issues about data quality. You know, what are you actually capturing? We've been at this at Citigroup since 2002. We have an extensive database. It's got over 100, I think, now, and 20,000 losses, 120 100,000 losses. And I don't know how much Oryx has, but you know, we may be a mini Oryx on our own within Citi. But you know, we still have major data quality issues, and then scenario selection and all those things. So this is just setting the background. As I said, the main points I wanted to get across here is, if you're doing this for, I'll use the Basel III language, for the going concern, I think most of these issues have largely been solved. And yes, you can refine them and you can get better estimates. But you know, you have to ask yourself, like if you're doing maybe research, a lot of these questions are still interesting. But as a businessman and a banker, it's sort of like, you know, we got it approximately right. The extra money I'm going to spend to get this, that extra 2% accuracy, I'm not sure is worth it. When you're talking about gone concern, then we really have some serious issues. Any questions so far? Any challenges? So, you know, we do all this and you expect a big round of applause from the businesses, and unfortunately that's not what you get. You actually get a general sense of dissatisfaction and what I call the blues. Right? It's been our experience at Citi, and I'm sure some of you maybe have had different experiences and I'd like to hear about them. But certainly at our institution, you know, we did all this and we spent a lot of money doing it and costs a lot of money to maintain it. And at the end of the day, most business managers just have a big yawn, right? So, okay, so you give me this capital. How do I improve my operational risk? What do I need to do to better manage my risk? And the fact is, after having spent all this money and time and effort and, you know, intellectual power, basically, we end up waving our hands. We really can't answer that question. The very first question I said, you know, is, does the modeling actually give us any insight into how to better manage operational risk? And now, so far, our answer is no, it hasn't. Now, this is just not my personal opinion. I mean, if you look at where is the value of operational risks in the last 10 years, and I'll quote you something with, you know, op risk and compliance. It's interesting, this is telling about the industry too. Op risk and compliance, I think, started out as op risk and operations management. And then, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, 7 years ago, it changed itself to op risk and compliance. And recently it changed itself to something else, maybe someone knew, but I can't remember off the top. Op risk and regulation. So it's trying to reinvent itself all the time. It's kind of a reflection of the industry itself, which is sort of, you know, wandering in the desert, trying to find some kind of meaning here. And, you know, back in Volume 7, which was, at, I think, about 2 years ago, it said, you know, I'm just quoting here random from that, from the editor's letter. It said, I think it, operational risk has hit crossroads. Fresh thinking is needed in op risk. The commemorative issue of January 2007 had the top 50 regulators, bank, risk management. Some of you here participated. You know, the common theme was we need to reinvent operational risk. I mean, so that was about 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half. And here we are today and still saying the same thing, right? So what to do? I think I said about this. Unfortunately, in most institutions, I think it's largely become a compliance exercise. Right? CEOs are increasingly saying, okay, you know, most of the world is on Basel. The US still isn't on Basel II, so there's still an opportunity there. But you know, in most of the rest of the world, you've done your Basel II, so most CEOs are saying, okay, the project is over, right? Now what? And you fulfilled your compliance exercise. What do we do with this group called operational risk? Because again, well, I'll wait for that because I want to put it in context. So what to do, what not to do, and unfortunately, too many conferences I've been is when they answer what to do, it's more of the same, only better, right? That's what I hear. We need to get better at modeling. We need to get better at incorporating scenario analysis. We need to get better at incorporating, I don't know, some kind of new distribution, GH distributions instead of, you know, the typical rule of thumb kind of log normal distribution, and people have gone way before, way beyond that. But, you know, is that going to help what the issues that I talked about that are important to the business managers, which are ultimately the ones who pay the bill and are going to decide whether we need operational risk managers or not? And the answer, in my view, is absolutely not. That's not their issue. It's not going to be more precise to find better and more of what we've been doing. We really need to do, you know, it's not more mathematization, as I call it, and it's not more detail. That's not the issue. Right? Some people say, well, especially if you're new at this, and you actually still hear about this in some of the more emerging markets. I just came back about 2 or 3 weeks ago from Bahrain, right? And their issue is still, oh, how do we collect operational risk data? And, you know, my advice to them was, yeah, collect the data, but don't spend all your time trying to solve that problem. It, you know, you could have the best data in the world, but that's not going to help you solve the other problems that are perhaps more important. Yes, collect the data. I mean, that's an important issue. But, you know, if it's 90% correct and 90% accurate, it's probably okay. The FSA got a, you know, they did a review of the listed banks in the UK and their subsidiaries in the banks, and, you know, they stressed something very similar. It says it does not produce results that are useful. Most firms still do not seem to consider the impact of business changes might have on their operational risk profile. What does that mean? It means, you know, you do all the modeling and everything, you kind of come up with a number, but it doesn't really reflect, maybe your business environment has changed. Maybe, you know, if a rogue trading event has happened, what do the models tell you? You? All of a sudden you need more capital for operational risk. But yet, you might need less because every firm has gone and reviewed all their rogue trading, all their controls around rogue trading and strengthened them. So at the very time when you are probably reducing your operational risk, the model is going to tell you you need more capital. And that's where the businessmen scratch their heads and say, you know, there's something wrong here. It's like, you know, go back to the examples. I always like to take operational risk and take it to something at a much more personal level that I can relate to. So it's like saying, you know, my neighbor, you know, or someone in the pool just had a car accident. And I say, you know what, I should go and take a refresher course in defensive driving. So I do that, right? I spend money to go take courses in defensive driving. And the insurance company comes to me and says, oh, that's very great. I'm glad you did that. But, you know, your premium is going up by 20-30%. You say, wait a minute. You know, I just reduced my risk. I'm just fresh out of this way of how to get out of an accident if I see one coming. And yet you're going to charge me more, something is wrong. You as a consumer would fight that, right? And insurance companies don't. In fact, if you take defensive driving, since they reduce your premium, even though you may belong to a pool of which the overall risk may have gone up. Right? But because you've taken specific action, they take that into account. Operational risk modeling doesn't. It penalizes you. So that's a big challenge when you're a business manager trying to make a buck, right? And you're saying, I do all the right things, and what did I do? Because some person at some institution, which I may or may not have heard of ever in my life, now I have to pay more. And this big thing about, you know, improve the management information because it was usually too detailed. I don't know about your firms. You know, we used to have an operational risk report that was about this thick. And as I said, first of all, it was all outdated information. It told the recipients nothing they didn't know. And, you know, part of the solution was, well, it's because it's not detailed enough. And that wasn't the answer. The answer is it was too detailed, right? What an operational risk manager wants, and now from my perspective as the CRO, which I'm not doing that, I'm the recipient of it, I say, you know, I want to know where the big risks are. I want to know what should I worry about? Every day I go into, you know, the bank, and I have a good profile. I have a sense of where our credit risks are. Right? And I talk to the bankers, and we have a good, interesting discussion about, you know, call it scenario analysis, but it's more like scenario analysis on the fly. You kind of say, okay, you know, I just read this in the newspaper. How's our portfolio affected by that? should we be doing anything? And, you know, sometimes a five-minute conversation, sometimes it's, you know, a two-hour conversation. You can do the same thing in market risk. Just walk around the trading floor, get a sense of what's going on, look at the reports, and we can have an interesting conversation about the risks. And then the operational risk manager comes and it's like, well, you know, we had this control issue, let's say, and we had this loss. And so my question is, has it been investigated by whatever it is? Let's say it was a processing loss where we lost money because we didn't fulfill a contract, and so we have to pay a penalty. I say, okay, well, did we do anything? Yeah, okay, fine, let's move on. You know, we have these, what are called operational risk reviews once a month. I go to them, and I scratch my head when I leave because, again, I have no understanding of what our risk profile is. All I know is that I rely more and more on the audit reports, which is a sad thing to say because we've come full circle. Right? If you went back to Basel 2000, where did you get your operational risk information? From audit reports. Now, at least for myself, and maybe I'm a minority, that's where I've come full circle. That's what I rely on, because at least it tells me, here are the big issues. If we don't solve them, we're going to have a potential event. I don't know what the size is often, but I know it's something I need to worry about. Or I read it and I say, oh, yeah, sure. You know, there's these issues, but even if they occur, it's not going to cost me a lot of money, or it's not going to have a big effect on what we do. And sometimes it doesn't cost me a lot of money, but it might have a big reputational effect, so I worry about it, and we try to solve it. We put a group together, say, okay, how do we solve that? But you see, that's what I would have done had I been there 10 or 15 years ago pre-Basel. So that's, when I look back, it's concerning to me that we really have not made that much progress. So my view is we need to go back to basics. And I've listed the sort of components, and everybody has their own version of this, but essentially the same list is there, right? You have some kind of governance process, you got risk identification, some assessment or measurement, monitoring, reporting, managing, and control. And I think there's serious issues with all of them, as my talk has kind of illustrated. Some of them I just glossed over, some of them I went into a little bit more detail. You know, we can spend hours talking about each one of them, but I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But I will mention this one, and then I'll go to the probably the risk identification. But this one here, what happened in most banks with operational risk management, it was just thrown in, right? Without any regard that most of these risks were already being managed by other groups, right? So you have, first of all, audit. Second of all, you have, say, business continuity. Fraud risks were all being dealt by, every bank has a security department. Information security, you had within IT, right? So I've talked about disaster. I'm just going through the list of, you know, the operational risk loss events. We talked about disasters, COB, continuity of business, talked about information security, talked about fraud, business practices. Well, we usually have a legal department that advises on the contracts to make sure that what we're doing. We have a compliance department to make sure that we're fulfilling all the compliance needs. And so all of these things were being done, and perhaps not in a coordinated fashion. But operational risk came along and said, you know, we're going to come and do this also, partly because of what? Because Basel said so. I mean, the only argument I've heard at the end of the day, and I take blame for that too, because I've used the same argument, was, well, you know, that's fine and nice that you don't agree with this, but Basel says we have to do it, so we're going to do it. Because at the end of the day, we never had strong arguments to say, here's the real value I bring to the table, right? An example I always give, I think once some of you may have heard it before at the CBA, was Canadian Bankers Association, was, you know, you go in a room, and there's a new product, right? So in a room, you have the various groups that need to approve this. And you go and you ask the credit risk manager, you know, can we measure the risk? Do our systems capture the credit risk associated with this? You know, the operations, can we do all the operations associated with it's a loan with disbursement, collection, and all that, you know, technology, all the various groups around the table, and they all have something important to say about this. Then you come to the operational risk manager and you say, okay, so what do you do? I mean, what's your opinion of this? And they either repeat what's already been said in a much more high level because they're not intimate with the details, or they mumble something about, you know, well, we need to make sure the model, there's sufficient capital for this new product, but they really can't tell you what's the drivers. Or they tell you something about, you know, well, any losses associated with this new product have to be captured into the loss database. So here's another issue, a very concrete issue of you're putting these unfortunate operational risk managers in very difficult positions of trying to answer what is essentially a very simple question. Okay, you're head of operational risk. What do you want? You know, what's your views on this new product? Should we do it or should we not do it? And unlike the other ones, they really can't provide concrete answers. So I think we need to go back to basics. First of all, if you look at a typical, and here I use SAS op risk data, but I could have used OREX and anybody, any other one. I can't use OREX because Citi is not a member, but we do subscribe to SAS, so there are others out there. And basically, you do some kind of, just very high-level analysis of the data. It could even be called analysis. But what does it show? First of all, it shows, you know, very high level. They differ by business lines. They show that, you know, this is the scale, of course, doesn't show this, but this is supposed to be the average loss. So they appear as if the average loss is about the same for everybody. But, you know, you can see that the multiple of large losses to average loss is quite high and varies by line of business. And it shows if you go then into a particular line of business, it shows that each line of business has some characteristic losses. For example, no surprise here, trading sales, it's unauthorized trading and illegal trading are the big ones. And if you were to do it for retail banking, you get a very different profile. And you know what? This is much more informative for the typical business manager than all of that modeling and mathematization that we've done. In fact, what it shows you is something that some of you who were in the early days of operational risk quantification, it shows you something very similar to what used to be called, instead of the AMA, it was called the IMA, internal measurement approach. And basically what it said is it's one step more granular than the standardized approach. So in typical business decisions, now risk management is a little bit different. Right, risk management, we try to measure everything. This is credit market risk also. We try to measure things very, very precisely. But in typical business decisions, it's the old 80-20 rule. Right, if I got something that tells me it's within 80% accurate, you know, I'm fine with that. For some reason in risk management, maybe because there's too many PhDs involved in it, I don't know. But somehow we have to become very, very precise. But think about any other thing in your bank, right? It's usually around, if it's 80% accurate, you go with it. I mean, think about your own thing. You're going to sell your house, right? And you try to precisely do so much analysis that you say the price of this house is, you know, $1,000,001. And you usually have a range that you say you're comfortable with. And that's how most business decisions are done. And I think we should start, when we go back to basics, start doing something like that. And the IMA and actually the standardized approach are better that. Our approach is like that. My advice to the industry as a whole would be, let's not spend time developing further and further refinements to the AMA. Let's just try to get the calibration, maybe of the standardized approach, better. And that will do. So the betas, you know, let's get them a little bit more precise, not too much, because we'll never get them precise enough. But we'll never get them precise enough from a mathematical sense, but we will get them precise enough from a business sense. And we'll get understanding. I mean, you know, sometimes we worry about risks that are just not there. And, you know, maybe if you're an experienced business manager in trading and sales, you say, well, this is obvious to me. I don't need some kind of loss database to tell me that. I know that. Okay, great, but a loss database might give you someone who's a novice in that and someone who's auditing it, maybe just say, you know, rather than focus on this thing, which day-to-day might be a problem and needs focusing, but from a big loss point of view, these are the only things I need to worry about, and I can actually ignore all of this, and it will make no material impact on my risk profile. So that was risk identification, manage and control. I'd like to introduce a little concept I've introduced many times, and I've actually found it quite useful at our particular firm. But basically what I do is, I'm doing for time. I like to divide the world into mechanical and adaptable. And then you have, within the mechanical, you have simple, complex, adaptable. You also have very simple and very complex. And, you know, somewhat simplistic view of the world, but I think a much more useful model than others that I've seen. And the main message here is that most of the time, the big losses occur here. They're as a result of a system that is complex and adaptable. Most of the day-to-day, sort of the average losses that we experience are actually in this zone here, heavily weighted in the simple mechanical and in the somewhat complex, but definitely not here. So, you know, processing transactions, what is it? It's a very mechanical process. It's routine. It's well-defined. You do A, you do B, you do C, you get, you know, Z as a result. Modeling, you know, marking to model a portfolio, it's not an adaptable system, really. It's quite mechanical. The math is pretty well-defined. Yes, we can refine it, but it's kind of complex, right? A lot of people find it difficult to understand because there's a lot of different relationships, unlike a simple, let's say, check processing system or credit card processing system. It's very simple, mechanical, easily understood. Here, the relationships are much more complex, but it's still mechanical in the sense there's no evolution. There may be evolution in the modeling, but at any given point in time, it's not like it reacts to what's going on. It's fixed. Stock trading strategies, a little bit more, the strategy, right, is adaptable to the circumstances. So that's, but it's still simple. It's not that complex. The strategy may be very sophisticated, but it can be broken down into a series of simple steps. And then here you could have, you know, things like structured credit product strategies, and the reason I put them in complex, adaptable, is mainly because the processes are not well understood, right? Subprime mortgages is a good example at the time. You go back now, you can say, well, we could probably move some of that here. But a lot of them were not understood very well, right? And we didn't understand that all the relationships that led to the tremendous mess that we ended up with. So I would put them more in adaptable complex. Now, the reason why we put this is because there's strategies for managing, depending on which box you're in, and the strategies for measuring are going to be quite different, in my view. The dominance is going to be whether it's mechanical or adaptable. And here's, you know, what we sort of do with it. If it's a mechanical process, then a lot of the kind of literature and Basel approach to operational risk will work, because generally, losses here tend to be normal, log normal, distributed. You have causal relationships, right? Big thing in operational risk was the big religious wars, as one regulator put it, was whether we should have a causal relationship view of the world or whether we should have more phenomenological view of the world, which means you just look at the results or do you look at the underlying causes. And if you're in a mechanical world, you know, like check processing, credit card fraud, you know, any example that's more a routine operation in a bank, I think these things will work. And the goal is here is no surprises, right? Now, suppose you look at, you move into where you have more adaptable structural, adaptable and complex, then a lot of these things don't work. First of all, there's a lot of unintended consequences. Julie Dixon, for those of you who know her, she's the chief regulator in Canada. She's the head of OSFI, the regulator of banks in Canada. And she recently said something that I actually think is very encouraging. She said we should rely less, this is in the context of what is commonly known, although I don't think the regulators actually refer to it that way, as Basel III, but it's commonly started to be known as Basel III, sort of what we must do to prevent the crisis, which in my own view is misdirected, but separate issue. What she said was, we should rely less on the rules and the regulations and more on supervision, because all our rules, no matter how good, are always going to cause a lot of unintended consequences. And so what you want is to step back and say, rules of the roads are kind of nice and we need some of them, but you know, let's not rely on the panacea of better and better rules, because they have a lot of unintended consequences because we don't understand all the interrelationships. You know, if you look at the current credit crisis, it really was all about this. I mean, was there a little bit of fraud involved? Yes. Was there a little bit of, you know, hype in terms of people knew exactly what they were doing, but, you know, hyped it up because there was a lot of money to be made? Yes, of course. But when you come down to it and strip all these things, it was whether it was on the regulatory front, and I just don't mean Basel, I mean some of the laws that were passed in the U.S. on mortgages, on leverage ratios for, you know, investment banks, and so on, they had tremendous unintended consequences, which, like all unintended consequences, after the fact, they're easy to observe and say, well, of course we should have known that. Well, that's great. And that's why lessons learned actually don't work, because you've learned that lesson, but you've learned a lesson to the past. As we progress and make more products and, you know, more rules, there's going to be more unintended consequences. So surprises are is the nature of the beast. It's not that we can get a world which there's going to be no surprises. Right? As a risk officer, I'm not. It's not whether we're going to have surprises or not that worries me. I fully expect I'm going to have a surprise. It's will we be resilient when this surprise happens? Right? Will we be able to come out of it, maybe not whole, but partly wounded, but at least survive? Right? And those are the kinds of things that I think we should focus on. And we look for hot spots. You know, we talk a lot about aggregation of KRIs and RCSAs, for those of you who have been involved in that, and that's been largely a monumental failure. It usually gets aggregated to the point of view that it's totally meaningless. And KRIs are very important if you're right in the intricacies of the business management, right down at the, you know, the floor level. But the further up you go, you get aggregated, and it makes no sense. Makes no sense because what I manage as a chief risk officer is very different than the what the day-to-day person manages, let's say, in fraud. So aggregating what he does or she does to me is meaningless. That's not the process I manage. I manage a very different process, so I need key risk indicators that are relevant to me for the processes that I manage, not an aggregation of what everybody else is doing. Because I'm more managing these, and they're more managing these. So, you know, if we look at the world, which is where most people look at the world from a mechanical point of view, you look at SocGen, and they say, oh, it was control failures. In fact, the vacation policy is what we need to do. And so you strengthen your vacation policy, right? Vacation policy, for those of you that don't know, is that you must take 2 weeks away from your activity, and you have no communication with that activity. So if you're on vacation, you can't communicate by BlackBerry or any other way with the people who have taken over. And now most of the big frauds have actually been discovered by situations like that. Right? If you look at all the big frauds, invariably they've been discovered when the person who was perpetrating the fraud was no longer in control, either directly or remotely, of the activity that was going on. And so this is a very important aspect of managing operational risk, but will it eliminate the risk of operational risk of rogue trading, let's say, in this particular example. And the answer, in my view, is no, because, you know, no matter what you do here, that will help you reduce the risk, but it won't eliminate it where you have no surprises, because we're dealing with human beings who are complex and adaptable, and so they'll always find a way around it. So what you say in the SocGen is really not just a control failure, it's actually more like an earthquake, right? So if you live in an earthquake zone, be prepared for earthquakes. And if you're in trading and sales, be prepared for rogue trading. It's going to happen. It happens all the time. Most of it goes unreported because they're small and they're caught when they're small, as opposed to they grow. So if you had Evel Knievel or whatever his name is, and Nick Leeson, right? If they had caught it the day they did it or a week later, the losses would have been small and manageable. It's only because they were usually, in some cases, went on for years and years undetected. So what you have to say is, I live in an earthquake zone, so I am exposed to rogue trading, and what do I do to manage that kind of risk? And so what I should be doing is what, you know, engineers do, and build buildings that could withstand any earthquake? No. But buildings that can withstand the type of typical, when I use that word in sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because there is no typical earthquake, and just like there is no typical rogue trading. Right? You look at all the rogue tradings that have happened, every one of them in some ways is unique. Do they share some characteristics? Of course. Every earthquake shares certain characteristics too. But they're also unique. And the lesson from there is not that we're going to learn so much from, you know, analyzing past losses. You will, to a certain extent, because you'll be able to solve things like this. If you had a very terrible vacation policy, you strengthen it and you reduced your risk somewhat. But the big thing, the big risk is still there. You're still exposed to it. So the question is, should I be having, you know, sufficient capital for that? And that brings me full circle to the very beginning of the talk, which is that example of the house. The answer is no. And I made it very clear to our board. One of the reasons I couldn't be here yesterday was I was actually at the board meeting, and we were talking about some of these very issues, and I made it very clear we will never have enough capital as a standalone institution. Yes, if we rely on the parent, we will, probably. We have $100 billion worth of book capital, at least, so yes, we'll have enough for a rogue trading event. But we, as Citibank Canada, will we have enough for a rogue trading event? The answer is no. And so now what do we do about it, right? So my challenge to you, as the thought leaders in the industry, is to say, how do we address this problem, which is much more relevant than some of the spending a lot of time trying to get the techniques of mathematization of operational risk better and better, more refined, more refined. Think about it as, we are in an earthquake zone. We want to build earthquake resistant, not earthquake proof, but earthquake resistant buildings. How does that translate to in operational risk? What do we need to do, which would be the equivalent of building buildings that are earthquake resistant? So how do we build a trading operation that's resistant and resilient to rogue trading? That would be a question that if there was a lot of intellectual power devoted to, I think not only would I be personally very interested in, but you would get a lot of attention in your institutions by senior managers. That concludes my talk. Thank you.
Thank you.